Rowanie's going to try again at some point, but we can go ahead and get started if everyone else is ready.
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 Good.
Great. Well, we're starting off the 2010-2011 season with Chris Gaffney's book, Temples of the Earthbound Gods. And I think we're pretty much all familiar with each other, but we can go ahead and introduce ourselves briefly, because I think this is both David's first times in the meeting. So we'll start off with the people here in Lansing, East Lansing. My name is Alex. Second year historian in the history department, studying soccer in Argentina.
My name is Ben Smith. I'm a professor of Mexican history here at MSU.
We can go on to either of the folks, or either of the Davids, and then Peter.
I'm David Roberts. I'm a fourth year PhD in geography at Toronto, and I studied planning for the World Cup in South Africa.
And I'm David Kais. I'm a fourth year PhD student in anthropology at the University of California, San Diego, and I study soccer in Mexican immigrant communities.
Great. I'm Peter Allegi. I'm a historian of Africa, particularly South Africa, and I write about football and popular culture.
Chris Gaffney. I'm a professor of geography at the Universidade Federal Fluminense in Rio de Janeiro. And I read my book.
Great. Well, we usually start off the meetings by just asking for some general insights from the author about the book writing process or the field work that went into writing it, or anecdotes you have from the publication process, what your intent was for the book and how that might have changed. So anything you'd like to discuss related to that that gives us insights onto the book outside what we find on the page?
Yeah, sure. I'll tell you a little about the story of researching and my process of getting to the point where it was a book comparing two cities. I wrote my master's thesis on soccer in the United States and the construction and how soccer was used to construct geographic identities, and ended up focusing on stadiums as the locus of production, or one of the loci of production for geographic identities through sport. And during that research, found that Buenos Aires had more stadiums than any other city in the world, and so went there to check it out. With the intention of continuing that as my PhD work. But I arrived in Buenos Aires in January of 2002, right after the peso had crashed in December, which made my research more feasible because it was cheaper, but it also made it incredibly tricky because the stadiums were sites of incredible violence and really saw the effect of economic hardship coming out through violence expressed through sport and police repression around stadiums, and was, you know, increasingly fascinated by what was going on in Buenos Aires. At the time, I had no intention of going to Brazil, and as I continued to return to Buenos Aires and got deeper and deeper into the workings of the Barra Brava and the kind of the underbelly of soccer in Buenos Aires, it became increasingly dangerous for me to be there. So I was, you know, chased from several stadiums. I was getting, into situations I probably shouldn't have been in, or I would never would have gone with somebody else. But as a solo researcher, I was able to put myself in situations where no one but myself was in danger, and I felt like I got too close to some of those things to really continue safely. And so, ironically, I went to Rio de Janeiro at the end of one of those trips and found the stadium experience there to be so completely different and much safer. And so, although the city itself was not. And so then I went to Rio and ended up doing 5 months of research, 6 months of research in Rio in 2004. And after having spent about 6 or 7 months in Buenos Aires, thought I had enough to start my archival research, which is much easier to do back in the United States, as the archives as Alex will probably be able to tell you as well, are not so accessible in Buenos Aires, and they're also not very accessible in Rio. But in Austin, I was able to start putting the contemporary scene and the geographic literature on space and identity and Latin American urbanism together with the historical context of Rio and Buenos Aires, which I admittedly had not had a lot of exposure to. And then made a couple trips back during the research to confirm some things, was very involved with sending my chapters out to people to have them evaluated. And then after writing the dissertation, or in the process of finishing up my PhD, I got a contract for the book. And then upon finishing the PhD, the dissertation just basically just threw that away and started writing for a different audience, and kept certain people in mind when I was writing the book. And those were, you know, a friend of his Irish immigrant friend of mine who was big into soccer but does not have a college education, also thinking of university colleagues that would be interested in the theme and might use the book for undergraduate teaching, plus the general educated reader, someone like my dad, who was very interested in soccer, had been to some of these stadiums in Latin America, and would like to know more about it. And so in trying to touch all those different audiences, I sat down to write the book and wrote it nearly about 4 or 5 months, and then realized that after reading through it a number of times, I needed to have some visuals and some more maps, and then spent a solid 3 or 4 months putting together all the maps and the photos and making sure that I was, and then so tweaking the book as it went along to concord with the visuals that I had, and then finishing up with a comparative chapter, which I think is probably the weakest part of the book, and trying to justify my methodological decisions, and then it was done. I sent it off. A couple of years later, it was out. So it was a long process, as you all know. So that was kind of the process of the book. And in the research, you know, there's one particular example that from Buenos Aires, when I was there at the end of my research in Rio, and there were, you know, of course I couldn't go to all of the stadiums in Buenos Aires, right. But I once went to this fifth division game between Sacachispas and Colegiales, or some, you know, random lower division team, the one that has the photo of Bin Laden, and there were only about 300 fans in the stadium, and the visiting fans arrived late, and they were escorted by the military police into a small holding pen, and were just incredibly violent, you know, behaviorally, right, going up the fences and shaking them and gesticulating and screaming. And then at halftime, they disappeared, but no one knew where they had gone. And what they had done was they had, and this is a fifth division game, Saturday afternoon in the outskirts of Buenos Aires, and I had gone there by myself, and they had jumped over the stadium walls and run around behind the home supporters and were just picking up rocks and breaking off tree branches and throwing them over the stands into the home fans section. And so the home fans started picking up these things and ran up to the top of the stands and started throwing them back down. And then out of nowhere, two police helicopters rise overhead, the military police with their dogs there run over and shut the gates to the stadium, and everybody's locked in. And I was just so astounded that such a low level of sporting endeavor could engender such tremendous passions when they're essentially similar groups, but just from different parts of the city, fighting over an incredibly small amount of football capital. One, you know, 3 points in a fifth division Liga Metropolitana. Mm-hmm. It's like people were willing to, you know, not necessarily die for it, but to really fight just for the sake of fighting. And that really cemented my ideas about how powerful the performance of masculine identities and the localization of that performance in the in and around the space of the stadium was for Buenos Aires.
Great. I wanted just to say a few words of the book about the book, and then I know both Peter and I think David Roberts might have to leave slightly early, so we can allow you guys to ask questions first. But first, I wanted to commend Chris on his book. I have some notes here to read off of, but there was three things that I really appreciated about your book, and that was the first chapter does a lot to establish stadium as a useful analytical tool in it, and as a point of reference for understanding culture and urbanization, governance in the city. And I've been lucky enough to actually just be reading this last week AHR roundtable on biographies, and one of the authors talks about using place as a biography, the biography of a place. And so I found a lot of resonance with what I was reading then, and I was really glad to see that first chapter standing on its own as an explicit effort to establish the stadiums as specific types of tools that do specific types of things, and we can get into that later. I also really appreciate that aside from maybe Arquetti in 2003, you have the most comprehensive list of secondary sources in Argentina, I think, that exists in an English language book. And you're also very ambitious with the temporal scope that you study. You start really necessarily with the creation of a body that was going to inhabit the stadiums before they're even building the stadiums. And I was really glad to see Julio Friedenberg's name in there, and I had a chance to talk to him about your work when I was in Argentina. And finally, I appreciated your willingness to take up very broad themes and speculate often on the wider social significance of the things that you were talking about in your book, speaking not only to just the Argentine case, but especially in the comparative case with Brazil. So I'm sure we'll get into the specifics of those three things, but there were three strong points of the book that I thought I'd commend you on, and sort of get some things on the table before we start. But
thank you.
Peter or David want to shoot off a question first?
Go ahead, Peter.
Did we...
Oh, sorry, I switched off my mic so that my daughter is watching cartoons. I don't want that to be our soundtrack in the background. I was just going to say, David, since you're from Chris's same discipline, you want to go first?
You can go first. I'm okay. Happy to see the floor.
All right. Yeah, I mean, I echo several of Alex's comments. I'm always pleased to read books about Latin America in English because I think still, and I said this, I think, when we talked to Roger Magazine about his Pumas fan study a few months ago, you know, the study of football in our neck of the woods in North America, but also I think in Northern Europe, is still dominated by studies of Britain, and also how sort of British football culture influences other parts of the world. And it's really nice to get out of that sort of Anglo hegemony. And I think Chris does a really good job of showing how the game was de-anglicized and indigenized very, very quickly. And so I enjoyed reading that quite a bit. So I just want to point to a couple of things that I found a little bit problematic in the book. As a historian, you know, I'm more focused on change over time maybe than you know, geographers are. But I was wondering whether you could explain why the chapters, chapter two, which is basically the historical chapter on Rio, and then chapter, the early part of chapter five and a chunk of chapter four, why the history only covers really the first three or four decades of the establishment of football, the creation of the first stadiums. And then there's nothing really from the 40s to the early 90s, and then we pick up with your contemporary analysis in the late 90s, early 2000s. What was behind that decision, and how do you think it impacted your analysis in the book? That's the first question I had. The second is not so much a question but a comment. I didn't quite understand why chapter 6 was the last one. It makes a little more sense listening to you talk about the process of putting the book together, following the dissertation fieldwork. But I thought that the chapter sort of on methodology was better placed earlier, perhaps, you know, interweave with the more theoretical chapter that begins the book. So that's just a question of how come you made that decision. And then the third point, really quick, has to do with the sort of psychohistory that you put forward in the section on South America, which is totally absent in the Brazilian, and I thought was not terribly convincing. So I wanted to give you a chance to kind of maybe go back to it and explain it a little more clearly, how you came to those conclusions.
Can you clarify what you mean by the psychohistory in Argentina?
Stadiums as sites of sexual sublimation, you know, imbalanced gender ratios and patriarchal cultures' influence on the game. The whole section you have between page 141 and 145 goes kind of really deep into sort of fears of emasculation, keeping Argentina out of international football, you know, lots of psychological explanations, which you don't see anywhere else in the book. And then, of course, the section on Cancha Concha, which was actually quite entertaining.
Okay. Well, I agree with your assessment of the historical gaps. And there was a point where I had to, it was either going to be I had to make a decision in terms of space, whether or not I was going to address the entire social and urban history of stadiums in Buenos Aires and Rio, or just address kind of the beginnings to some crucial moments and then take up the story later on. And that has been, filling in those gaps has been, I thought, better left to others, although I would now include more reference to that, because of course a lot of changes happened with the military dictatorship and in both Argentina and Brazil, and the rise of the Barra Bravas after 1968, and also the Torcidas Organizadas in Rio and their role, their political roles, and their impact on the use of the space of the stadium. But as I was writing this, there wasn't much in the way of fundamental, I didn't see much in the way of fundamental changes in the way that stadiums functioned in either city from the 30s and 40s until really the 90s. And so I had to make a, you know, decision for the number of words that I had in my book contract, and also the, you know, the information that I had at my disposal to really dig through the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, you know, which is, you know, 40 more years would have probably added another 60 pages to the book, at least. And so I just made that decision not to do it. Those gaps need to be filled in, not only in terms of the history of urban planning, the historical trajectory to the cities, but obviously the way that the stadiums function in those eras, which I admittedly don't know enough about. And so instead of doing a kind of a half-assed assessment of those, I just decided not to do it at all.
I see.
So hopefully that goes some way to clarifying what your question there. In terms of why I put chapter 6 as the last one, the comparative chapter with the methodological justifications, was basically not to, which relates to the question of the audience I was trying to reach. My primary goal was to get people hooked and get people into the book. and not just writing for academic audiences. And so I thought that the first chapter was already pretty heavy theoretically, and setting up the stadium as an object of analysis. And so I thought that justifying my methodologies after people had read through them, because I assumed that there would be those questions that needed to be answered at the end. And so when people were having read my two very different approaches to these two different cities, I thought that having read those two different approaches, people would be saying, well, wait, these are uneven treatments. This is, you know, one is very much about the psychology of masculinity. One is very much about the role of the stadium in race and politics. One looks at all the stadiums or compares different kinds of stadiums, but the other one just looks at four specific stadiums. And so having exposed the reader to those different approaches, I felt it necessary afterwards to synthesize, not tell people what was coming. And so it was just a choice of style and I guess author's discretion to put the methodological comparison at the end as I was comparing the two chapters. And that made more sense to me at the time. I think I would do that again the same way, although I can't say for sure. And finally, your third question about the difference in the psychological history or the role of the stadium in Argentine psychology, or the role of Argentine psychology and the role of the stadium, had a lot to do with my particular experiences of Buenos Aires and Rio. Porteños are much more introspective people than Cariocas across the board, and Buenos Aires has supposedly, one of the myths is that it has the highest concentration of psychoanalysts in the world. And so that figures very heavily in the day-to-day perception of the city, the role of the stadium in the psychological history of Argentina. And my particular experiences of those places tended to confirm that. And other people might have different experiences. But certainly, masculinity and the performance of masculinity was much more at the core of what I saw in Buenos Aires than in Rio de Janeiro. And in Rio de Janeiro, the role of race and the role of football in sort of creating the myth of a racial democracy in Brazil is much stronger than the role of race in the stadiums in Buenos Aires. Of course, those things are present in both, but not in equal measure. And so I felt that the strongest thing that I was able to take away, and of course the Concha y Concha distinction is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but not terribly. Once I hit upon that idea, it just kind of stuck with me as a good one. And so I concentrated that chapter around those things, leaning heavily on people like Arquette for those insights. And I had many conversations with him before he died about the role of the stadium in producing those masculinities in Argentine stadium.
Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you.
So I guess I'm up. I again would like to echo the appreciation for a work like this. I've been struggling a bit to place my project, which doesn't actually take much in consideration in the stadiums in South Africa, but definitely looking at soccer as a geographical, as influencing the geographies of a city, trying to figure out how to place it within geography in general. So I'm definitely taking from your first chapter quite a bit in terms of kind of ways of thinking through geographies and geographies of the city. I have to admit that I'm not that familiar with South American soccer in general, so much of my read was for my own kind of learning than critique. So my questions pretty much reflect how you... how this kind of insights into the role of soccer and soccer stadiums in particular to the identity formation in cities would translate to like the South African case. For example, in Durban, the new stadium was constructed not in a remote part of town or not in a cheap or relatively inexpensive retail place in terms of land value, but rather right downtown, and actually becomes an iconic kind of part of the city skyscrapers. It's just right along in same in that same vein, and was done so with very much deliberately. When the city sent out its bids for construction and for ideas from architectures, they cited things like the Montreal Olympic Stadium, for better or worse, as an example of something they were trying to mimic in the construction of that stadium. So very much, yeah. So I guess I would just like to hear your comments in how you would kind of think through the South African experience in a similar vein to how you put together this work. Obviously, I recognize it's not your kind of right. Area of expertise, but just some comments would be fantastic.
Sure. Well, I would tend to think about it in the South African case as a very much as a before and after story. You know, what were the stadiums before the World Cup, and what's left now? And so, from my impressions, and never having been to South Africa, but my impressions are that before the stadiums were relatively small. Probably a lot of wooden and small concrete stadiums that were, if not necessarily open spaces, but more reflective of the economy of teams. And that, you know, perhaps mm-hmm. capacity is not in excess of 25,000, no electronic scoreboards, no, you know, scan or barcode mechanisms, no VIP lounges, is what I'm assuming what things were probably like before, with relatively low iconic projection, and which is to say that the stadiums were not as extensible, and that they're not communicating architectural messages across time and space, and that the new South African stadiums are constantly radiating ideas of globalization, of a concentration of wealth, of the new quote-unquote South Africa, that are also highly exclusionary spaces. And while those stadiums are symbols of the World Cup, they also reflect the growing distance of FIFA and the World Cup from the lives of ordinary people. And so to have that message constantly radiating, and also to have a space that is essentially dead, because it's only, I'm assuming that most of the World Cup stadiums are only open for games, they don't have social centers, they probably don't have movie theaters or shopping malls, or if they do, then they become sites of consumption, which limits them to a very, very small public. And so they are constantly symbolizing those socioeconomic relationships, which are basically, from my perspective, top-down impositions of global capital and the political elite of South Africa combining with FIFA to reorganize urban space in a certain pattern that accelerated the flows of capital out of the country and not necessarily into the country.
Thank you.
David.
So I appreciated the book, and I am going to ask a question that I actually kind of hate when other people do, so I apologize in advance for doing it, which is basically to ask you to speculate on something that you didn't cover in the book. And what I'm interested in is, and this of course reflects my interest, if you were to have a third comparative section that included the United States in it, I'm curious what issues you would choose to look at that you think would be most revelatory, given that you were choosing different ideas in Brazil and in Argentina. So I'm curious what you, how you would approach that if you were doing the same project, looking also at the United States and the role of stadiums in this country.
Okay, it's a good question. And I had a little bit in there about the, you know, global, you know, the stadium as a as globalized,
right?
About the U.S. I would look at the role of public policy in the management, the construction, financing, and management of stadiums. Because the United States stadium landscape is completely dominated by the antitrust exemption for major league sports teams in Congress. If we're not for that exemption, there would be more, we'd have perhaps have a promotion and relegation system. We wouldn't have teams be able to sit hostages to build new stadiums. And might have a model that was more reflective of what happened in Argentina. In Brazil, I mean, I would make the comparison between the public policy of building stadiums with public money in the United States, and also compare that and the intended goals of that policy, which is basically to provide a subsidy for private enterprise so that the city will attract, theoretically, corporations or whatever,
mm-hmm.
Or give the population a sense of belonging to a big league of some kind. Whereas in Brazil, the public policy of building stadiums was so directly political and had such played such a role in the maintenance of a populist politics and a clientelist politics, that is a very different, has a very different end goal than the public policies in the United States. Although it's, they're both with the accumulation of power. I think in the United States it's accumulation of economic power. In Brazil is the accumulation of political power. And then in Argentina, it's about controlling, and the public policies related to the control of the stadiums are more interesting because there are very few public stadiums in Argentina. I think the only one I know of is the Estadio Único in La Plata. So the ways in which public policy direct not only how stadiums get constructed, but also how they're managed economically and how they're policed are all very interesting elements that I would write about if I was comparing those three.
Uh-huh. Thank you.
Welcome.
This is all fantastic stuff that I can riff off of, but I wanted to just return something real quick. I wanted to sort of back Chris up in that gap, that historical gap that I also definitely noticed during the book. This is one that I've become more and more familiar with because it's the gap that I want to address. I was noticing from her bibliography that a book called The Pachitude of Multitudes by Shetty Palomino is really the only book that sort of covers that time period in any sort of systematic way. And even then, it's only a history of the Football Association, basically, of the AFA. So it's a problematic gap in the book, but it's also a reflection of the problematic gap that the academics that are covering soccer in Argentina have tended to be sociologists like Arquetti and Alavarces, who have sort of worked backwards from reflections on the 90s to make some historical observations, and then the historians that are working on it have tended to start at the beginning in a systematic process. So we're getting a lot of good scholarship on the teens and 20s and going into the 30s, but it's hopefully getting covered, and hopefully I can be a part of that as well. I wanted to also comment that something that I'd hoped to see more of, but I realize the difficulties that would have meant to go through it, especially focusing on Lobo Moneda, is an actual sort of economic and political history of the construction of the stadiums themselves in Argentina. And I know why this is so difficult, because the clubs guard their documents very well, and it's been very hard for even Argentines, especially Argentines actually, to gain access to those documents. And I wanted to point to the work of a sociologist whose name is Mariano Grushetsky. And he's just written a great chapter in Julio Friedenberg's new book, which I can pass on to you in PDF form if you're interested, Chris.
Very much so.
The chapter is called Actores Sociales en torno a la construcción del estadio de Club Atlético Vélez Sarsfield. So it's the story of Vélez Sarsfield stadium construction, and his is a very intricate history about sort of the political actors involved in the stadium and the activities of the club itself in sort of doing a sort of boosterism to get their stadiums built at local and national political levels. So drawing sort of the membership bases and having membership drives to increase their membership levels and then be able to petition their local leaders and their national correspondents to lobby for funds. So I'd hope to see a little bit more of that in terms of the Bombonera story, but having interacted with Boca Juniors already, I know how closed they are. So I don't fault you for that, but it's something that does need to be done.
And so many stadiums that, you know, each one has such a particular social history that you could have 70 books about the 70 stadiums in Buenos Aires.
Yeah, and it's really, I think, what needs to happen, actually, to have a better picture of how people were speaking to the state during that time to lobby for public funds, not only through soccer, but through the development of neighborhoods. And I think the coincidence between neighborhood identity and stadium identity is something that can flower into all sorts of levels of analysis that we can interact with. But concrete question I had, I wanted to ask one for Rouhani, actually, since he's not able to participate via audio, but I wanted to ask one for him, and then I'll ask one myself. But his question is, which stadiums did you encounter where the original design purpose, maybe even the physical layout, were co-opted by the populace and refashioned or repurposed in an alternate way? Likewise, any cases where club officials tried to control their design structures and limited audience agency? I'll ask my question after you get to that one.
Well, in it's more, I guess that would probably in Rio, and the original intent of, so let's say, the Maracanã has been now completely repurposed.
Mm-hmm.
So the original structure of having these very open spaces, once you hit the 1999 or 1998 was the last year that the Maracanã retained its original infrastructure, and from then on, public authorities have increasingly segmented the space of the stadium in an attempt to control it or control what went on there. And now, as in the run-up to 2014, the Maracanã will be unrecognizable both visually and architectonically from the way it was in 1998. And so that, for me, that's one of the most clear examples of public or the owners of the stadium, which is a state agency, refashioning the architecture of the stadium and appropriating that for their own economic ends, if not political ends. I'm not familiar with a lot of other examples from Argentina where the original architecture, other than the Bombonera with the Tribuna de Maradona, has been reshaped and refunctioned for particular use. Okay. So I think that's all. I hopefully answered Ronnie's question there.
Yeah. You talk about sort of the understanding on page 146 here. You talk about the understanding of the historical development of stadiums in the context of the gender development and networking of urban space and culture in Buenos Aires as being an essential tool in making sense of contemporary functions and uses of the stadium. And I noticed that your gendered analysis for contemporary in both cities was sort of drawing off a lot of recent literature on gendered analysis, and then your past gendered analysis was dependent a lot on Abgeti. And I just wanted to ask what's sort of the way forward with that in looking at the years that I'm going to look at? Or do you have any new reflections on how you treated that? Just because I feel like you have some of your strongest points and weakest points in the same analysis of gender, actually, in that I think you very correctly, and a crucial component, I think, of understanding the historical development of soccer is its rigidly male space. And I think you do that very, very well in demonstrating how spatial locations inside of the city not only reflected that, but reinforced it and solidified it as part of Porteño life. Whereas maybe some more contemporary stuff, I wasn't sure if maybe outside of Buenos Aires or maybe in the interior, some of the statements might have been sort of disputed on male views of the acceptability of homosexuality and et cetera, et cetera. So, sort of what's the way forward, and do you have any insights on how you're using gender analysis on your own that can speak to some of the points that I raised?
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems where I had a discussion of the book with some graduate students at UNM a few months ago, and one of the professors there asked me how I would teach this, how I go about teaching this book, because there's so many different things in it. And so to pick apart all the things that go into structuring an analysis of gender are incredibly complicated. And it's not what I was trained as. I was trained as an urban cultural geographer. And so my own understanding of gender comes from a spatial perspective. And I would absolutely have to read more about the social production of gender relations in Argentina, which can only be done by hitting the books and talking to experts in the field. And right. So I would, in the historical era that you're looking at, reading through the newspapers or looking at how or popular representations of sport in film, in magazine articles, in soccer magazines, and looking at how the male body or female bodies are represented in relation to the space of the stadium, doesn't tell you exactly what's going on, but it gives you a lot of clues to what's going on. Right. And so the weaknesses that you point out, I agree with. There are weaknesses there, but again, it's how deeply do you want? You have to make a choice about how deeply does that element play into the story that you want to tell? Because it is at the end of the day, it is a story and it is a book, and it's a very particular way of seeing things.
Right. It's going to be very helpful for me I think the story you tell, especially a contemporary one, especially when it comes to gender, is of the Varas and of the Varas conceptions of gender. And I feel like it was very enlightening to find their sort of their workings with gender, especially in the Bombonera and sort of all the psychoanalytical sources that you draw on to discuss that. But I also felt like maybe some of the other perspectives on soccer were also getting flattened in that the most violent, the most misogynistic of groups probably is getting a larger voice in this story than maybe is representative of what soccer stadiums actually look like outside of maybe, El Clásico between
River. Uh-huh. I agree and disagree with that, and that the violent, but the on one hand, of course, the Super Clásico is one thing, but as I was explaining before, the Sacachispas Colegiales game I went to is not a Super Clásico, and it's still like that. And the third division games are like that. And it's not necessarily overt violence, but even the structure of the stadiums, with the Alambrados Olímpicos with barbed wire on the top, is a sign of the potential violence that's always there. And all the stadiums have that. And so there's kind of an implicitness about the potential for violence at the stadium that is relatively dominant. And of course there are people that go there with their girlfriends into the platea and have a very peaceful time, and they come and go to the stadium. as billions of people all over the world do. But for me, what was happening in Argentina was extreme at all levels of the game.
Right, right.
Okay, can I just insert myself briefly here on this point?
Go for it.
On page 194, there's a statement, this is in chapter 6, that 36% of Buenos Aires fans said in a survey that they bring spouses and children to the stadium. And I was curious as to how this kind of impacts this argument that the stadium, as Chris is talking about throughout the book, in Buenos Aires is a, you know, overwhelmingly male space, also suggesting that it's kind of young, single men. Because it seems to me that, you know, 36% is a lot of people who don't fit that typology, that category. Can you say a little bit more about that? Because it seemed that sometimes you were so eager to make your point that you were sort of dangerously close to kind of essentializing a little bit maybe the culture of the city and of football, but also maybe overlooking some of these internal stratifications within Buenos Aires society.
Yeah, there are a lot, you know, bringing spouses and children to the game is a normal practice in all the world, and the divisions within the stadium were fairly distinct. So in the popular sections, it was overwhelmingly young men, simply because you have to, you know, physically, it's difficult to maintain your place. In the platea, which you would see couples, you do see people on dates, but as a percentage, and you know that survey may have its errors as well, as a percentage of the stadium population, it always seemed really relatively insignificant to me. In counting, standing in the stadium and counting numbers. As recently as 2000, I was only there in 2006, and with many other people, they were universal in saying that the presence of women was statistically insignificant in the popular.
That is a reference to a particular section of the stadium, like a curva?
Yeah, the curva.
Right, but it seems to me that that's a particular part of the stadium. I mean, to generalize what I grew up with is the curva, and to generalize that is the entire stadium is I'm not sure whether that you're doing that, but that was sometimes the impression that I got, was that these larger points were being made by extrapolating the experience of a significant number, probably the loudest, the most choreographic, most interesting group, but that's not really representative of the entire experience at the stadium.
Yeah, correct, which is why I put in a survey saying that 36% bring their wives or spouses or children to hopefully diminish that sense, and making also the point, I think on a couple of occasions, that there are differences, different ways of watching the game in different parts of the stadium.
Oh, but it does raise questions about several things. I mean, you make a big point about how it's going to be about gender and sexuality, essentially masculinity, in the chapters in Argentina, and maybe, you know, the emphasis should have been on the barras in particular, or on the, what are they called? Sorry, the what are the ends called in Argentina?
Popular.
The popular, yeah. Because, I mean, I think you could have made some pretty similar points in Argentina about national identity that you made in Brazil, and it would have been a different book in some ways. But anyway, it seemed to me that there was a little bit of unevenness there, but also you were a little bit undermining your argument by representing the dynamics in that way.
Okay, I'm going to think about that a little bit. Thank you.
I mean, how about fathers teaching their sons how to act in the stadium, for instance? I mean, is that a place in which those forms of masculinity were reproduced in particular ways? That masculinity was not simply the aggro of the popular, but it was perhaps also, you know, handed down generation through generation in a slightly calmer setting. You know, I mean,
right, absolutely, without question.
You know what I mean? With magazine, we had a fascinating conversation about these kinds of things because he really spent a lot of time within the Pumas, two uh-huh. Pumas groups, and so he was able to really dig deep and uncover some of these things. And I thought some of this was a little bit sort of overlooked in your analysis. But again, I don't know. I'm not an expert in Argentina, but these were some of the questions that came up. Sorry to take up so much of your time.
No, not at all. I think it's a very valid point, Peter, and one that I perhaps thought I had identified in the first part in the introductory chapter. With obviously there's a difference in watching the game from different parts of the stadium that I perhaps then ignored in the part on Argentina, trying to make the point about the overt aggressive masculinity and the socialization that happens in the popular versus the more sedate masculinity and behavioral patterns that are passed along in the other sections of the stadium.
I was very glad to see, and I think I missed it on the first time through, and I stupidly forgot to flag it this time when I saw it. But there's a tension that you identify. I think it's in the final chapter. Here we go. It's on 192. You talk about sort of the city stadiums as intersecting the public and private realms, and it's it might be sort of the driving question behind my piece. I'm talking about sort of the politics of ownerships on not just stadiums but clubs in general, and how, especially in Argentina, because of for historical reasons, the intersection between public and private realms is sort of a daily reality of the clubs in terms of how members use their clubs, in terms of more of asociación civil, in terms of using their sedes and participating in sort of a community facility organization, as to when they get very abstract globalized commercial levels like maybe the marketing group in Boca might represent. But I was very excited to see that you identified the intersection of the public and private realms between private management and public governments, state control, civic organization. Was that, and like I said, I could have browsed over it earlier in the book, but was that something that you struggled to find sort of more points of tension for? Because I feel like gender was a really big point of tension in the Argentine chapters, and race was a really big point of tension in Brazil, and I feel like maybe for the next book, like you were talking about, maybe having that point of tension between public and private be more of a centerpiece and a driving force. Do you see the possibilities of that, or did you find it hard to do that the first time?
It was hard to do that the first time, and it's hard to do it now, especially as I'm researching what's going on with the preparations for the World Cup and the Olympics in Rio. That tension is central, especially when who's benefiting, who manages these stadiums, how are they going to be paid for, who gets the use value out of these huge public investments, and how do these stadiums as iconic public spaces function to generate profit for private enterprise,
right?
And so it's a hugely complicated issue that's difficult to model geographically, and it's difficult to really figure out, and especially in Rio, the difference between a public stadium and a private stadium. because they're both governed by the same laws, although they have, you know, and so for instance, when you go to the Maracanã or the Engenhão, now you cannot drink beer, or you can't sell beer within a certain radius of the stadium. But if you go to the Vasco da Gama Stadium, which is private, you can drink beer on the sidewalk
right
in front of the stadium. And so are these, they're governed by the same laws on one level, but on the same, on the other level, they're not at all. And so it's incredibly confusing.
Right, right. Well, I think we're cut down just to us three, and I think Peter has to go, but I hope you found it stimulating in terms of discussing the work, and I know other authors have really enjoyed being able to have the opportunity to have people that are directly invested in their research discuss it. But thank you very much for joining us. And
thanks for putting it together, and look forward to the next one.
And,
I was going to say, Chris, please stay with us because, you know, we're a small group, but obviously having experts join the group is important, and people who cover different parts of the world make it all the more fun.
Absolutely.
Yes, and especially from different disciplines. Laurent Dubois was going to join us too,
yeah.
But he was unable to make it. And unfortunately, the shuffle with trying to get in Goldblatt, basically, we had a jump you in on short notice, or else we would have had better numbers today in person especially. But hope to get in more people from different disciplines, and retaining the past authors has been a really big goal of ours, and John Turnbull's been really busy with a new project, but not sure what happened to Alon either, but
he's on the West Coast, so
but
all right, well, listen, it's been a pleasure. Thanks, Chris, and you are in my bibliography in my new book, and I've got some of your insights in there as well. And it's been great talking with you.
Absolutely, we'll be in touch.
All right, cheers.
Yeah, cheers,
Chris. I wanted to mention something to you real quick. The turning on the video here, since this just you and me last year, actually. Actually, I'm gonna end this call and call you back real quick if you have a minute, Chris.
Okay.
Okay, I'll call you right back.